Hey, this is Cedric Youngelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. This rip with American HODL about how Bitcoin is the best drug on earth and how the Bitcoin mafia is going to take over the world is brought to you by the Bitcoin Advisor. At the Bitcoin Advisor, I am here to help you get your Bitcoin off your exchanges, simplify the process, address your Bitcoin challenges, and ensure you feel confident every step of the way. I can help you set up your multi-sig and secure your Bitcoin for decades to come while ensuring you can sleep at night with the right estate planning and asset protection strategies to make sure your Bitcoin is safe for you and your family. If you or someone you know needs help buying Bitcoin and creating a multi-sig vault, I'm here to help. Head over to the bitcoinadvisor.com/Cedric. thebitcoinadvisor.com/CEDRIC. Now, and put some time on my calendar. The link to set up time to chat with me can also be found in the show notes. I'm more than happy to chat, explain what we do, and how we can help you secure your Bitcoin for generations to come. River is the Bitcoin exchange of choice for the long-term investor. I've been using River for over 3 years now because they are a Bitcoin-only company that has earned my trust through their proof of work. Securely buy Bitcoin at the tightest spreads in the industry. Have peace of mind thanks to their 100% full reserve cold storage custody and enjoy zero fees on recurring orders. River built and owns their own infrastructure. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. If you need help getting started or have questions, River has U.S.-based phone support for all clients. Use my referral link in the show notes to get started and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin. Your Bitcoin deserves the best protection. With Thea, you're in charge. No more fears of losing your keys or falling prey to hackers. Their self-custody multi-sig vaults empowers you to be the ultimate guardian of your Bitcoin. Share the power of secure Bitcoin with your loved ones like I have. Thea is my favorite multi-sig solution because Thea enables shared custody, making it a family-friendly choice for safeguarding your digital legacy. And for those unexpected moments, Thea's got your back. Their multi-device vaults with both assisted and sovereign recovery options mean your Bitcoin is safe, always accessible, and ready for the future. Thea is more than just an app. It's your partner in the Bitcoin journey with 24/7 support from a team that cares. Download Thea now using the link in the show notes and get your first 6 months free and experience the new standard in Bitcoin multi-sig security. Alpa Energy Bars, a new kind of energy bar. Live life untamed. Question everything. Alpa Bars are made with high-quality Colorado grass-fed beef, American-sourced fruits and nuts, and nutrient-rich beef tallow, so they make for a great pick-me-up. When I need a meal replacement, snack, or just some much-needed fuel for the burn, and I don't want toxic fiat sludge, I reach for an Alpa premium meat bar. If you don't believe everything you're told, if you break the rules, strive for freedom, reach for your peak, and don't follow the mainstream, then you're one of us. On the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, we question everything, including what real health is. The Chad of energy bars, challenging the norm and supporting freedom. Go to eataupa.com, eataupa.com now and use the code MATRIX for a discount. The link can also be found in the show notes. Come take a break in the best vacation spot for Bitcoiners, February 3rd. It's going to be an amazing weekend in Tampa, Florida. Join us for an extraordinary night of networking, entertainment, and giving back, all in the Bitcoin Bay style. The Sound Money Soiree promises to be a one-of-a-kind experience, connecting the Bitcoin community with Tampa Bay's most influential Bitcoiners. The Sound Money Soiree event features a dynamic poker table, an electrifying DJ, an enticing silent auction, and a delectable all-you-can-eat-and-drink culinary experience that embodies the essence of Tampa Bay's finest cuisine. Go to bitcoinbay.live, bitcoinbay.live, and get 15% off your tickets when you use the code MATRIX. The link can also be found in the show notes. On Sunday, February 4th, we'll be gathering leaders in the Bitcoin space as well as the regenerative beef and health movements for special pre-summit panel talks and a fireside chat with Texas Slim from the Beef Initiative and myself. Get your tickets today at beefsummits.com. That's BEFSUMMITS.com. The link can also be found in the show notes. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin matrix with American HODL.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
It's not every day that we get a legend up in the house. The man, the myth, American HODL. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
What's up, brother? By the way, that's a dirty lie because I've seen the guest list and you got all the best OGs come on the show. So,
all right, I'll make an admission. So there's a lot of reasons I started the show, but if I think about who I wanted to talk to the most, it would have probably been you when I started the show. Definitely top three.
That's awesome.
The reason why is just listening to you on pods and on Twitter in like 2018, 2019, probably specifically in 2020 a lot. And I'm sure you remember, but just the posts about stacking sats, the Cash App posts and the in your face tweets and you know what you talked about on podcasts. So this is an honor for me, a feather in my cap. So I'd love to get into it. I'd love to go back to the beginning and, you know, kind of get into how you sold your car in order to have enough money to live and drove around on a shitty Chinese made scooter order to stack sats. So I don't know where the exact beginning is, if that's the rabbit hole story.
I'll give you the whole story. We can do the rabbit hole story and then it'll lead us into that. But let's see, like, so, you know, 2011, I'm a young moron living in basically what is a frat house with no affiliation to an actual frat. You know what I mean? Just me and a bunch of young idiots drinking beer all the time and doing whatever drugs we get our hands on. And I had heard about the Silk Road from this comedian, Duncan Trussell, who was on Joe Rogan's podcast a lot and still is. And they were talking about it back then when Joe Rogan's podcast was much more niche and counterculture than it is today. Today, it's like the biggest podcast in the world. But back then, it was like very niche. And they would talk about stuff like Bitcoin and drug money and, you know, how to buy drugs on the Silk Road and whatever. So I'm listening to this. I'm thinking, dude, I got to get my hands on some drugs. And so me and a buddy like do the research. We're looking into it. You know, we basically decide against it. But like part of the whole process is you had to get Bitcoin in order to, you know, purchase whatever you were going to purchase on the Silk Road. The reason we didn't end up doing it is because it was a federal crime to send drugs through the mail and everything was traceable. And so I was like, yeah, it's kind of dumb. I'm not going to do that. So I didn't end up doing that. And then flash forward a few years later, it's like 2013. My same friend who I had tried to buy drugs with on the internet came to me at the bar around Christmas time, 2013. And he's like, dude, do you remember Bitcoin? I was like, yeah. And he goes, it's $1,200 right now. And I was like, what? Because when we had looked at it, it was like $7 or something. So I remember sitting there nursing my beer, just being like, fuck, this was my opportunity to get rich. I fucked it all up. Like I'm a moron, you know, whatever. Then flash forward another few years, I stumble out of a casino drunk the next Christmas, like 2014, and I had won like $5,000, and I was like, you know what, I'm gonna check in on Bitcoin. I wonder how Bitcoin's doing. And it was way down. It had gotten clobbered in price. I think it was trading around 200, maybe just under 200, down from 1200. And so, you know, I was kind of stupid, but I knew enough to be like, that seems like a good deal. So I bought some, and then, you know, like 2 days later, I finally was like, okay, I got to start researching this, see what I actually bought, see what I'm holding. And then that was where I had like the epiphany where I was like, oh my God, this changes everything. Like we're now standing on the precipice of like a new monetary revolution. And this is going to define the next decade plus of my life. And that kind of brings us up to date to today. The moped story is a little bit of a side. That's when I, in 2015, I got really obsessive. I fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and started putting everything into Bitcoin. Like, I'd get those phone calls from my wife, and it would be like, hey, yeah, Chase says that our account is overdrawn. I'd be like, don't worry about that. Like, I just bought a bunch of Bitcoin. And she would be like, what? And I'd be like, yeah, don't worry. Like, you know, and she would be like, how much did you buy? And I would be like, you know, X amount of dollars. And she would go, that's all of the money in the account. I was like, it's not all of the money in the account. It's just most of the money in the account, you know? So there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. And she, my wife at the time, who was my fiance probably then, needed money for her tuition payment for graduate school. And I had to come up with $5,000. I didn't have $5,000 at the time. I was like in between gigs. You know, I was an entrepreneur, so I'd get paid randomly. And I was looking at my car, and it wasn't a very good car. It was a shitty Dodge, and it was worth about $5,000. And I was like, fuck it. I'm just going to sell this rather than sell the Bitcoin. So I sold the car instead of the Bitcoin, which I think Bitcoin is trading at $500 at the time. So that was like 10 Bitcoin. That decision saved me. And for the rest of the year, I drove around on this fucking Chinese moped called the Tao Tao 50. And everywhere I went, people made fun of me. You know, it was great. It was very character building. And like now, many years later, I actually like enjoy it fondly looking back on it. But at the time, it sucked. It's pretty shitty, you know.
I can imagine. The dedication. So what did you do before, living on a Bitcoin standard or whatever it is you do now? What kind of did you do to stack stats?
Yeah, so I was a filmmaker. I owned a production company, and that was how I used to make money. I used to shoot music videos and commercials for clients. They would pay me, and then I would take basically everything I earned and, you know, buy Bitcoin with it. And I was doing that pretty aggressively, like all through 2015, 16, 18, 19. I kind of skipped over 17 because things got really bubbly that year. Obviously, like that's when the Bitcoin price went to 20K. So I took a pause on my stacking, and I later determined that was a mistake to take a pause on stacking. So that was when because when I took my foot off the gas, I think the Bitcoin price was like maybe it was $800, which is a shockingly low price in retrospect, right? And so then after living through it and seeing the price never come back down to $800, I realized I was being, you know, incredibly sort of short-sighted by not continuing to, you know, accumulate more Bitcoin, take more territory on the Bitcoin network. So, you know, I just kind of created this character, which is American HODL, and came out online and sort of, you know, in 18, 19, when the price was like really, really low, like 3,200, I was like, I'm going to rectify this mistake. And I'm also going to help everyone else rectify this mistake, because I'm going to be like really aggressive and in your face, and like kind of turn stacking into like this, you know, game of brinksmanship where like we're all trying to outdo each other, and it's like a friendly competition. And I think, you know, like I feel proud that kind of culture still continues in Bitcoin today and that people still do that. Because yeah, it is like just a good way to motivate each other. I've found that like the Bitcoiners who get involved in the Bitcoin community, or at least have some Bitcoin friends, you know, a few guys who are in Bitcoin, or even if you just listen like to your podcast or another podcast, and you're hearing a lot of Bitcoin stuff every day, it helps reinforce it that you're not the only crazy person in the world, that there are other crazy people that believe the same things that you believe, and that, yeah, these internet strangers sort of low key, like support you more than the people in your own life sometimes. And they believe that your vision of the future can come to fruition. Whereas we often find that family members and friendships that we've held for many decades, even can sometimes, you know, not see that future for us. I don't want to be like put too fine a point on it, but like sometimes the people in your life really, truly don't want you to succeed, and internet strangers do, which is weird, you know?
Yeah, I think the people in your life could really stick to their frame of you, where they think of you as little Tommy or little Timmy or little Sally. And
yeah,
they couldn't have discovered, you know, the world's next reserve currency, because maybe CNN would have obviously told me about it first before this little kid I knew forever.
And but what they don't realize is that there's actually something weird about you that they just never knew. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I've described this as like your Slumdog Millionaire moment, where I think this is true of all of us, you know, especially Bitcoiners who are early, because we're like sort of an island of misfit toys. We're not high polish, you know, guys that went to, we don't have McKinsey and Goldman on our CV. We're not part of Larry Fink's crew. Like those guys are joining Bitcoin now, but we're not those guys. We're the weirdo guys, right? And we're from the early days. And if you remember that movie, Slumdog Millionaire, there's nothing particularly special or interesting about that guy. He just happened to have lived the perfect life that led to him answering all of the questions. And the same is sort of true for people who got into Bitcoin early. It's like you had all these cultural touch points and life moments and experiences that led you to see this, 10 years before everybody else, in some cases. And, you know, that thing is sort of the thing that, you know, separates you from other people. So many of the people in your life probably don't even like didn't notice that about you at the time. I think that was true for myself.
Yeah. I mean, I guess everyone has kind of a different version of how everyone sees them, or maybe even different circles you run in, because maybe you left home and different people see you maybe in a different way and you got used to that or something. But,
yeah.
What do you think it is? Sometimes I think the only thing that really brings Bitcoiners together, because I don't really think there's like an actual community, or that we all like the same clothes or the same music or, you know, the same anything in particular other than truth. But I've heard you kind of talk about is maybe we've all been traumatized or share trauma.
Yeah.
So I think institutional
betrayal, I think, is a touch point for not just the people that are in Bitcoin, but more and more Americans, because let's face it, like, and more global citizens too, but like the institutions are not, they're not fit for the digital age. They're not fit for the internet age. They're not serving anybody anymore. It's kind of like this emperor's new clothes phenomenon where like we can all see that they're naked, but they're all wandering around pretending like they're not naked. And we're like, dude, your dick is out. And they're like, no, it's not. We're like, it is. And it's kind of small. We were expecting more, you know? I mean, there's a lot of that going on in the world today. And, you know, I think that when you trust an institution, okay, and then it harms you. Think of all the guys that, this is not my story, but think of all the guys that went to Iraq or supported the global war on terror, based on what we now know were lies, and they watched their friends die, or they were harmed themselves, or, you know, psychologically or physically. That's a pretty heavy toll and price to pay for somebody else's agenda, right? And it was an institution that you had formerly trusted that harmed you, and you found out your trust was misplaced. And I think that's like an extreme version of the story, but every American has a version of that story that we all feel nowadays. And that this is also a generational disconnect, right? Where baby boomers have less of that story. The greatest generation had very little of that story. Gen Xers have more of it. Millennials have a lot of it. And Gen Z, they're like, what institutions? Like, we don't even know what the fuck you're talking about, you know? So yeah, I think that's something that binds us as well, is that we're all just kind of realizing that the system doesn't work and it can't continue on the way it has before. And, you know, in a certain way, I think that a lot of the politics we see for younger people under, let's say, 40, came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement. The 08 financial crisis is still affecting us to this day, much in the same way that I think the pandemic is going to affect us for 20, 30 years, where, you know, there were a lot of people aligned on the problem in 08. The problem was the 1% versus the 99%. It was the fact that the game was rigged, right? Some people misunderstood the message to mean rich people are bad, because that's an easy, palatable message, right? But the real thing that was going on there was the game is rigged. None of us are participants. These people, they're allowed to socialize the losses onto the backs of all of us, and they're allowed to privatize the gains and take them behind these gilded, you know, walls where we don't have access. And that's morally wrong, right? And if you look at, you know, the paparazzi mags of the time, like, this wasn't TMZ, but it was like pre-TMZ. And, they would follow hedge fund guys like out of their, Wall Street like offices and take pictures of them and be like, look at this guy. He just got a $50 million bonus while his bank is getting bailed out by the American taxpayer. Like, there was a lot of that energy going on. Mm-hmm. And that energy was sort of corrupted and displaced and bastardized, and it splintered. And the corruption and the bastardization of it became identity politics and wokeness. The splintering of it became the sort of left libertarians. They went socialist, right? They went AOC Bernie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the right libertarians, they went Ron Paul Bitcoin. And so you can see the splintering, the fracturing. And I have this like sort of social theory that those two wings have to collide again and do battle for supremacy. Like, so whoever's vision of the world is more whole is going to win out. And if you look at the left-wing version, the socialist vision of the world, they're basically saying we want the game to continue, but we want to be the ones to pick and choose the winners. And Bitcoiners are saying we want a fair rules-based order so that nobody's in charge of picking and choosing winners. And I think one of those is a fundamentally, you know, much more fair and egalitarian vision than the other. So if I'm betting on it, it's obvious where my chips are placed. They're placed with the Bitcoin Ron Paul guys, you know.
Right. Yeah, I get that. And what do you think? You mentioned there that 2008 is still with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of 9/11, I would have thought that would still be with us, and 2008 by now wouldn't have been. What are your thoughts on 9/11? Is that still with us?
Yeah, of course 9/11 is still with us. Yeah, I mean, we haven't escaped we're still being crushed under the boot of everything that happened during the GWAT, the Global War on Terror. We live in a totally different America than what we were born into, me and you. And it's a fundamentally less free America. So yeah, I mean, 9/11 was, in some respects, like, I hate to say this because this is the narrative of Osama bin Laden. Hmm. But like, I do think that when, you know, history, if America is to fall in the next, like, let's say 100 years, 200 years, I think when history books look back, they'll look at it like it ended with 9/11, because we suspended a lot of our fundamental liberties and freedoms then. We got things like the FISA courts, the surveillance state. Yeah, I mean, we're basically running pre-crime on the American citizen today. There's a million horrible things that came out of it, you know? And Edward Snowden, who tried to, you know, tell us all what was going on in an unconstitutional fashion, is a, you know, fugitive who's constantly persecuted by the state for doing what I think is the right thing and what a lot of people think is the right thing. Doesn't feel good, does it? So, like, yeah, I mean, these big events in history, people like to sweep them under the rug like they're just, oh, that was, you know, gone and forgotten. Yeah, 9/11, who remembers that? We're dealing with the fallout from 9/11 today. We're dealing with the fallout from the great financial crisis today. And we'll be dealing with the fallout from the pandemic for the rest of our lives. Because I think also in the mind of a young millennial, as somebody who was at impressionable ages when I was living through these events, 9/11 showed me that I'm fundamentally not safe, right? That, you know, the military industrial complex who's supposed to be protecting me is not actually protecting me. The great financial crisis showed me that, you know, the stock market is rigged, the game is rigged, America is rigged, capitalism is rigged, and it doesn't work as it's been advertised. And the pandemic showed me that most of my neighbors are Nazis who are simply awaiting instructions from a Führer. And that's a lesson I can never unsee. So, you know, these all came at impressionable times, too. It's like when I was, you know, 9/11 happened when I was in middle school, right? And, you know, you want to feel safe when you're like when you're in elementary and middle school. And then the great financial crisis happened as I was entering college and the workforce, right? And then the pandemic happened as I was starting my family. And so all of these things came, they hit just at these perfect times where you just, it reverberates like a gong through your being. And yeah, you're never going to forget the lessons of any of these overhangs, and we're going to be dealing with them for 20, 30, 40 years, and we're going to see their, you know, tendrils sort of metastasize and become whatever the next historical calamity that we're forced to live through is going to be. I can't predict it ahead of time, but I know it's coming and it's going to suck. I know that much.
Maybe we'll talk about 2024 bingo card in a little bit, but I do agree. I mean, with 9/11 as an inflection point, especially if you look at like the 1990s, maybe that was peak America.
Yeah.
Is when families sat around the table and there were like hardly any arguments. And even it was depictions and culture, film and TV was all positive. People were getting along. People didn't have these sort of these lines between us. You mentioned before about sort of poker, and are you still a gambler? How do you deal with volatility?
Yeah, I wasn't a poker guy, but I was a blackjack guy. So high limit
I
blackjack.
limped them to, yeah, I lumped it together there.
The poker guys would be like, the blackjack guys are fucking degen monkeys. Like they would view me the same way I would view like a shitcoin NFT trader, you know,
Right.
which is true. It's accurate. So yeah, the high limit blackjack is what I used to like to play, and I did learn a lot about enduring volatility at the table, because the volatility at the table is horrific. I mean, just the worst, right? And so you can start with $1,000, and then you're down to 100, then you're back up to 3,000, then you're back down to 200. I mean, me and some of my more degenerate friends would sometimes sit at the table like all night, you know, for 8, 9 hours, and try and win it all back on whatever, $100, $200, whatever we could scrape together. And it was fun and it was exciting. And in retrospect, the amounts of money were not that large, though they felt large at the time. But it was a good sort of pressure environment to, like, it was good practice to learn about how to stomach the emotional volatility of the world, because there's this like fake idea called stasis that doesn't exist. You can't find it anywhere, right? Like it doesn't exist in nature. There's no static system in the world, nothing. Like there is not even a single example of it. And yet human beings like to believe this myth everywhere they go. They like to believe it about themselves, about their lives, about their relationships, about the market, about the corporations, about the entities they deal with. We love to pretend like things are static and unchanging. And because it hides the simple, horrible, awful fact that like we're swimming in a cosmic ocean of uncertainty and volatility and risk, and none of us want to feel like we're, that susceptible to the whims of the cosmos at any given time. But we are, and we're just fleshy meat bags who can die at any moment, So it's like, that volatility, like preparing for that volatility and hardening yourself against that volatility and accepting it as a reality. I think these are important traits as an investor, especially in Bitcoin, because Bitcoin's hyper volatile compared to the average investments. Although I'll ask you this, is it really? Because think about it, Bitcoin just continues to make new blocks, right? Like every 10 minutes. And we have a fixed issuance supply curve for Bitcoin that we know 100 and whatever 20 years in advance. One Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. So what's actually volatile? Is it Bitcoin, or is it the thing we're measuring Bitcoin in, which is the dollar? And I would argue that the dollar is actually a lot more volatile than Bitcoin itself. But still, we think in dollars, we price things in dollars. Our lives are still in dollars, as much as maybe we don't want them to be or whatever. But like they are. And so the volatility of the swings of the dollar on, and your Bitcoin trading pair, it hurts. It's emotional. And you got to just, yeah, the only way to get through it is to get through it. My friend Rob Hamilton has this great quote where he says that diamond hands can only be formed under pressure. So you got to just expose yourself to the elements and become an outside dog, outside cat. You can't live in the house, the warm house anymore, you know?
Yeah. When Rob was on the show, we talked about his piece regarding Eric Weinstein and stagnation since the 70s. And I don't like going to the casino. Maybe if it was free, I would enjoy the games. I don't mind playing them. I just hate giving away money, and I see it that way. Once in a while, we end up on a cruise and or some weird place, and we see it as an entertainment, a little bit of a budget. My wife likes to play the games. I always end up at the roulette. I find that I don't know what you'd call the people at the roulette table, or craps, or slots. I don't know if we're degens too, but do you see Bitcoin as gambling?
No, I did when I first got into Bitcoin, though. Before you know anything about Bitcoin, it's very easy to see it that way. And so, yeah, the thought in my head when I left the casino was, I want to keep gambling. And then the second thought was, oh, I should look into those fake internet coins, that Bitcoin shit. And then, the next day I bought some Bitcoin, and I was like, ah, this will be fun. I'll watch this go up and down. And then I finally, researched and looked into it and realized that this is it's a very big thing that's happening here. And it's like an absolute challenge to the existing the status quo, and that, you know, we're living at the monetization of event of a new form of global non-sovereign, non-state currency, the likes of which has only happened in humanity one other time, which was the gold standard, which, you know, happened in prehistory, and we don't know how it happened because there's no documented proof of it happening. So, I mean, yeah, it's a pretty big idea for us to be, you know, staring over the precipice of this massive change and be here at this moment in time to experience it. And then once you figure that out, and then you figure out the properties of Bitcoin, what makes Bitcoin uncensorable, you know, unfuckwithable, immutable, you know, sort of a, you know, impenetrable fortress of validation. You realize the beautiful game theory behind Bitcoin's design, all of these things. Then you really start to appreciate it for what it is, and you view it as a certainty. And, you know, it's interesting. I've never talked to a person that understands Bitcoin fully that doesn't view it as a certainty. I've talked to people that know a thing or two about Bitcoin who don't view it as a certainty, but I've never talked to anybody who has a really what I would call like a, you know, a deep grasp of Bitcoin fundamentals, and they don't view it that way. It's hard not to once you like know enough about it.
You mentioned this is a moment in time, and I agree with everything you said there. Big reason why I do the show, and thinking about, you know, your influence on your tweets and the bear market and sort of that mentality. I mean, it's the reason I structured the show the way I do is to kind of give people that hope and that, but more than just hope and hoping, but more conviction. Right. And just different angles of looking at that. And, you know, I wonder though, you know, are we making a difference? And I will say, you know, you've made a difference in my life and my family's life. And, you know, I own my own choices. So I look to no other man or person, you know, yeah. To, you know, I'm more interested in ideas and stuff, but I do like when I find people who have really good ideas from time to like more often than not, and, yeah. You know, I'll give them a little bit more time. But do you think we're making a difference? I mean, when you think about, and when I say it, like, you know, when I think about like low time preference thinking and I balance that and I think, well, what the hell am I doing on Twitter all day? You know, and am I making a difference there? Yeah. You know, and do you think we're making a difference? And what's your thoughts on that?
I think that if you're I've thought about this a lot, actually. And I think that if you're a good person, and you realize what's happening with Bitcoin, so you have your like epiphany moment with Bitcoin, you're then going to feel a tremendous sort of sense of responsibility, almost bordering on like survivor's guilt, that you simply must tell other people about Bitcoin. You must spread the gospel, which, you know, the original etymology of gospel means good news. It's to spread the good news. And so like you it's a compulsion. We all just feel compelled to go out and tell people about what we've found. And there is some marginal benefit for all of us in doing that, because, you know, each additional hodler increases the marginal value of your stack by like X small amount, right? And so, yeah, we do it for somewhat selfish reasons, and I think, but also somewhat selfless or altruistic reasons, which is, personally, if I had found this thing and kept it to myself and ended up with life-changing money because of it, I would have felt like, you know, like Gollum or something. Like I found my ring and I kept it in the woods to myself, and I was like, my precious, right? But knowing I did my best to tell other people about it gives me just, you know, a sense of relief. And it's like, okay, yeah, you know, if this thing takes off and a single Bitcoin goes to $100 million a piece, $1 billion a piece, like we're in hyperinflation territory. I was one of the people who was ringing the, you know, the bell. I was sounding the alarm and saying like, yo, we hit the iceberg an hour ago, please get in the lifeboats. So I think that, if you're on the Titanic, we've already hit the iceberg. You can be one of the guys that helps, or you can be one of the guys that pretends to be a woman, which is very in vogue these days, and then gets on the boat himself. By the way, how would they have handled trans on the Titanic? You know, is that a question you want to get into, Cedric? I'm just kidding. But, you know, probably we would have left them behind, depends on which one you└.
Yeah, that's a third rail that I'm going to let float out there. So, but how about those Mets?
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
No, it's fine. And there are no third rails on the show, so feel free to continue to hit on them. But what do you think about apathy? You know, I mean, are people apathetic towards Bitcoin? Do people care enough? And I want to, you know, bring up, you know, one of the other people I really wanted to talk to in 2019 was Bitcoin Tina. You know, and you guys, talked all the time in Clubhouse. And, you know, there were those moments where, you know, you do have that aha moment. There were several with Bitcoin where it's an aha moment on different levels. Like, this is not just about the tech. Aha, you know, come for the gain, stay for the money. Whoa, it's not just about money and financial freedom. It's about privacy and freedom of expression. And I believe when you get your very first sats, like, just a freedom to your mind to be like, wow, no one controls these things but me. It's not about having a lot of them. It's just a way of different looking at your sovereignty for yourself and a way of gaining self-sovereignty that was nearly impossible before Bitcoin, at least in the digital space, maybe not in the physical realm. But do people care? Is apathy maybe our biggest hurdle?
Yeah, I think that culturally nihilism is really, it's certainly much more prevalent today than it ever was, you know, 30 years ago. So I don't remember a lot of nihilism in the 90s. You know, maybe there was a little bit of it. Like, I think like stuff like Nirvana was like an offshoot for whatever nihilism there was, or like Marilyn Manson, stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, there's always going to be like teen angst. And, you know, the 90s were a period that was very much like the 50s. And so, like, obviously not everybody fits perfectly into that box. And so, yeah, there's going to be some misfits who feel a certain way about things, et cetera. But I mean, the majority opinion today seems to be that life is shitty and it's only getting worse, and that our culture is on the decline, our institutions are on the decline, our money's on the decline, our health is on the decline, our familial relationships are on the decline, the church is on the decline. I mean, it doesn't stop. Like, what isn't on the decline? We don't even make good movies anymore. We used to be the guys that exported culture to the world, and now all of the movies suck. You know, like, that's a big tell. Like, you look at stories on Twitter and stuff, and it's like, you know, airplane doors are falling off. We used to manufacture the best airplanes. We used to make the best movies. We invented Coca-Cola. Goddammit. Like, we were America, motherfucker. And you know, it's like, now we're looking at this like steep decline, and I think the most troubling thing about it is that nobody cares. Nobody seems to care. It's just like, whatever. Somebody else's problem. You know, what am I supposed to do about that? Huh? You know, it's like, okay, well, listen, maybe here's some things you could do. You could, you know, work out more. You could, you know, develop relationships, meet people in person, save your wealth in Bitcoin. Like, I think that a lot of Bitcoiner advice is centered around this sort of like fundamental reorienting of how to have a quality life, right? So like, if you listen, sometimes Bitcoiners get shit on Twitter for being like, you should eat a carnivore diet, or you should cut out seed oils, or you got to go out in the sun with no sunscreen, and like these like lifestyle things that hover around Bitcoin. And it's like, maybe all of those are extremes because it's a snapback from the place we've been at in life. But certainly, listen, eating a lot of meat is better than eating a lot of Cheetos. Going out in the sun is going to, you know, provide you healthy vitamin D, right? Seed oils do seem to be pretty toxic and obesogenic, so cutting them out is not going to be a problem for you. You know, and then there are other lifestyle things that sort of hover around Bitcoin. I think these are about Bitcoiners sort of reorienting themselves in terms of how to, you know, claw out of the nihilism and have a quality life. And we found other things that, you know, having integrity, having principles, being honest, you know, being community oriented and community driven. Like, this is the advice that a grandmother would give you, right? Start a garden, you know, meet your neighbors, right? Like, this is what your grandmother would say. And so sometimes people say Bitcoiners are radical for saying shit like this. And it's like, nothing could be less radical. Like, this is really grandmother type advice, you know? And this is just the precursor to what comes next, because once you understand Bitcoin, it's like, okay, you got Bitcoin. You got a certain amount of Bitcoin. They're going to X amount of millions of dollars, you know, whatever, in the future. You're going to be wealthy. Okay, done. We checked that off our box. Wealth. Well, okay, now I got to be around to enjoy that wealth. Okay, fuck. happiness or health. Let's check that off our box, and we'll start getting, you know, start getting healthier. We'll go to the gym and we'll eat better, yada, yada. Then you go, well, shit, I want people to share this with. Okay, happiness, boom, relationships. I got to take the same compounding power that happens in Bitcoin, and I got to use them for quality relationships. And I got to be, you know, I have high integrity, have principles, you know, build trust, have honesty with the people who know and depend on me. And then if I total those all up, maybe I'll have a good life. And maybe if I have a good life, I'll have some excess capacity to do something good for the world, right? And I think that's like the core of the reorienting that's happening in Bitcoin. And I think it's great, man. I think it's beautiful. I think it's awesome. I love watching that process play out. I'm certainly a different person than when I first got into Bitcoin. And it's not just aging, although aging plays a role too. It's also Bitcoin, Bitcoin culture, thinking from first principles, reorienting around what is real, what is true, what is right, how to have a quality life. And most people, the apathetic people, I can't sleep. I should go get a sleeping pill. Maybe it's like, why can't you sleep, right? Or, oh, I'm depressed. I should go get a, or, oh, fat. I should take a shot, take an Ozempic injection. You know, I mean, these kind of things that go on. And it's just not it for the people that are stuck in these old patterns.
Our connection got a little.
You lost, Cedric.
Yeah, I got our connection got a little wonky.
Yo,
there.
You back?
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
You froze on me for a second.
Did that get recorded, or you want me to take it?
Yeah, if you can go back maybe a minute or two, kind of, because it was like recorded in a like, but it was like it would freeze up and then you would freeze.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we could just move through it.
Is it on my end or your end?
That I'm not sure. And
yeah, we just move through it. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny when you were talking about sort of teen angst and radical teens and, you know, youth. You know, in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, I'm sure, you know, growing up, you know, you saw kids with, you know, green hair and mohawks and, you know, punks, rebels, whatever it is. And I don't see as many today. But anyway, about like in the middle of the pandemic, I was in the suburbs of Chicago. And I saw, you know, a young couple somewhere between 14 and 16, I'm guessing, maybe 17, and all punked out and they had the mohawk. And these looked as the most rebellious kids I could find in the suburbs. And they were wearing masks. And they were holding hands, though. It was a boy and a girl.
Yeah.
This is what really confused me, because they were probably going home to make out or something. And probably in defiance of their parents somehow. And they were on a deserted suburban street, just holding hands, wearing masks. And I was just, where is the real angst? Like, and I'm not saying like, go get in trouble, kids, but like, you don't have to, you know, listen to everything the adults are saying or to believe everything they're saying if it's not true, or if your mind is saying it's not true. But like, it just seems like there's no pushback. There's no life in these, a lot of the kids. And I think the pandemic crushed a lot of souls that way.
Having like green hair used to be a sign that you listen to like the Sex Pistols, and now it's a sign that you're non-binary. You know, it's like totally shifted.
Right. You gave a great talk at BitBlock Boom, and about the Bitcoin Mafia, and so we kind of, you know, we think about being a Bitcoin as a rational optimist, you know, and. What do you see maybe as the future on a Bitcoin standard in a Bitcoin world? What sort of responsibilities do Bitcoiners inherit, or what is the Bitcoin Mafia to you?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So in a very big, broad sense, the Bitcoin Mafia is every person who hasn't been born yet, you know? So it's like most of the Bitcoiners that will ever exist are not born currently, and they will be born in the future. And so we, the people, the dummies basically who stumbled onto this at the right time, right place, we have this sort of great responsibility to push wealth into the future. That's my big belief. I think a lot of people disagree with me on this, and think that, you know, dynastic wealth is somehow inherently negative. And I would counter and say that that's a psyop by the state to get you to pay taxes. Because I don't think that any great human project or endeavor can really be completed in a single generation or in a single lifetime. I think all of our best projects are multi-generational. And so these projects should be funded, and they should be funded over the generation. So like the Bitcoin mafia to me is this sort of, by the way, the term is based on the PayPal mafia, who, you know, there were a bunch of guys at PayPal, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, Max Levchin, et cetera, who were at PayPal. They all made their first, you know, deca million, 100 million there. And then they took that money and then they invested in the new generation of, you know, Web 2 startups that were popping up. And a lot of that money found its way into Facebook and LinkedIn and Uber and all this kind of stuff, right? So I think of the Bitcoin mafia as being the wealth that's generated by Bitcoin is going to be extremely useful for long-term human endeavors and human projects, because this is wealth that, unlike other wealth, unlike other currency, we can more easily push into the future. So like, for instance, I could take, you know, X amount of Bitcoin, let's say 6.15 Bitcoin, and I could time lock it for my great, great, great grandchildren, descendants I will never meet, who will never know me. And I can gift them a substantial amount of wealth, right? And nobody in the interim can touch that wealth. So I can leapfrog generations in terms of inheritance planning. That's a pretty powerful thing. We haven't fully dealt with the ramifications of that yet. And I think that, you know, we have a responsibility to look out at the terrain now and see what can be done with the highest ROI. So what projects can we do with our Bitcoin wealth that are going to be the highest ROI? And you have a responsibility that if you can't find one, or if you don't see any that exist, rather than to do what like maybe the baby boomer generation did, where you live in this sort of hedonistic way and you spend it all on, you know, experiences and luxuries and frivolous bullshit, basically, you have a responsibility to, in my opinion, take that wealth and push it into the future, where a descendant of yours or an organization of yours that you've endowed will have the ability to take a shot on goal at a later time, right? Mm. And I think by thinking this way and by doing things in this way, we could actually get back on track as a society, because long-term thinking is crucial. There's this new clock that Jeff Bezos created that costs $40 million. They put it in a Texas mountainside where it's gonna tick once a year, and it's gonna last 10,000 years. And they built it as a monument to long-term thinking. And I just love that. I love the idea of it. I love everything they're doing. I love the organizations that think long-term. I think Bitcoiners should think extremely long-term. Marty Bent, you know, sometimes talks about seven generation thinking. And yeah, you do need to plan out for the future ahead. And that's all the more reason to live with high integrity in the here and now, you know, because your family name is going to mean something. World concepts that are coming back to the forefront. And so it's going to take some time to get used to it. But I do think this is where we're heading and where humanity is heading.
Yeah. And I mean, I agree. And I love the way you think about it. And maybe taking the flip side of that, though, you know, sort of with the advent of the Bitcoin ETF, do you see maybe a 6102 sort of executive order affecting Bitcoin self-custody in America or something like that?
I mean, certainly there are certain politicians who shall not be named, because we don't want to give them any more press coverage. But there are certain politicians who hate freedom and are trying to ban self-custody for no reason, right? Like, you got to remember that 6102 happened when we were on a fucking gold standard. So the government needed the gold. So realistically, a Bitcoin 6102 shouldn't occur until we're on a Bitcoin standard, when the government needs the Bitcoin, right? And then it should occur, and then it will occur, right? But right now, we're not on a fucking Bitcoin standard. So any politician that's trying to stamp out self-sovereignty and, you know, self-custody really is just a person who, an anti-American sort of, you know, zealot who hates freedom and wants to trample on people's rights for literally no fucking reason, right? So in my opinion, we should, in a world that works rationally, we shouldn't see a Bitcoin 6102 until the government gets on a Bitcoin standard. But we live in an irrational world, and so we are going to try and see politicians attempt to stamp out more and more freedom, as much freedom as they can possibly kill, until that occurs.
Right. Yeah, we've seen that play out. What is the plebe movement to you, or pleb movement? Now, how do you prefer to say it?
Pleb. I used to think of it as plebe because it's plebeian, but that's like or the root word of it. But it's pleb. I've been corrected because an Italian friend of mine told me it's plebeian, and I was like, oh, okay, then it's pleb, I guess. What's interesting? I've had a lot of different thoughts about the pleb thing over the years. I was there when it first sort of formed and started. And now I've come to this conclusion about it that it's people clawing their way out of nihilism. So like it's people who usually are newer Bitcoiners. They are first couple of years in, maybe like first 2-3 years in Bitcoin, and they're still kind of stuck in the fiat mines. You know, they're still working a shitty job, saving up. They've found Bitcoin and suddenly they have a lot of hope, but they kind of don't fully believe it, you know? And I think this is, by the way, this was true of myself too. In the first few years, like I dared to hope that, you know, this was real, but I also kind of kept one foot grounded in the nihilism of the past where I was like, maybe I'm going to lose all my fucking money and everyone's going to laugh at me. Right. And that could happen. And I think that a lot of the people who I see who self-identify as plebs, I think, are going through that emotional journey. And they sort of, you know, eventually rise out of it and, you know, become like, it's almost like plebs are like tadpole Bitcoiners. And then you sort of rise out of plebhood and you become like a full Bitcoiner. There's this other idea that like pleb is, you know, like I'm a pleb, you're a pleb, we're all plebs, like I am Spartacus kind of thing. And I like that idea too. But the reality of that's like the cover story for the reality of the movement, which the reality of the movement is like you're halfway in, halfway out of Bitcoin, and you're kind of struggling, you know, just with you're struggling with the nihilism of your everyday life, you know, and it's tough because also like if you're only a few years into Bitcoin, probably you're in a situation where you haven't seen a massive bull run yet, or you came in during a massive bull run and then it's just been all pain. And I absolutely like salute people for going through that because it sucks. I mean, I go through it too. It's fucking awful. Every time it's awful, and like it shouldn't be, but like it never gets easier. Each cycle is compounded in terms of how hard it gets because, you know, what's going to happen. Like you think it's tough now to like get in and you lost some money and then your friends laughed at you or whatever. But wait until it works. You have life changing money on the table. Your whole world's about to change, and then it just fucking collapsed. It's like that's a tough moment too. There's a lot of tough moments in the hodling journey. So yeah, I think those are the two ways you can view the pleb movement: either as like an I am Spartacus thing, or as like a slow climb, or like a clawing your way out of nihilism.
Yeah, I mean, for people who kind of ask this, you know, hodling get easier you know as you get richer. You tweeted this out on June 25th, 2023. Unfortunately, hodling gets more difficult as you grow richer. You're going to reach this place where you have enough money to buy everything you ever wanted, be set for life, and then it'll be ripped away from you. That's a tough moment. I've seen it break people. I kind of compare it to I'm class of 2017, but I've kind of been looking at cycles, especially since Bitcoin, but just I kind of compare it to, you know, obviously where a lot of people don't realize, I think a bull market is harder than a bear market. I mean, a bear is just like you can hodl with a bear and it's all, and you're just hanging out. And with a bear market, like you can really only lose what you put in. So you sort of have like a limit to what you can lose. Like I bought X amount of Bitcoin, $5,000. I could go to zero. I'm going to lose $5,000. In a bull market, it's sort of infinite what you can lose because it can always go higher than what you're at. And so you're always like, oh, now if my $5,000 is worth $100,000, do I sell now or is it going to go to $1,000,000 for me? And so in your mind, you know, and that's what makes the bull is literally trying to throw you off by going down. I mean, the bull just doesn't go up and it's more volatile than hanging out with a bear who's sleeping, you know, but you don't want to hang out with either one, but you know what I mean? So when sort of talking about like, so the pleb movement, one of the things that was really fascinating to watch. Well, actually, I want to turn to we're talking about sort of this too smart for your own good. There was an episode with, I mean, Marty Bent and Marty Bent's show, TFTC, is fantastic. He did an Epsilon show with Epsilon Theory.
Yeah.
With Ben. And I remember there was a lot of discourse about Twitter on it. And so maybe you have a take on this, but it was this episode where, you know, he kind of thinks that we're too smart for our own good. And he kind of likened Bitcoiners to potentially being like coyotes.
Right, and
he
told
a story where, you know, he moved out to the country from the city. He took his Wall Street money or whatever it was, and he went to retire to the country. And he had his house dogs, and they would go roam, and they had an electric fence. But there were wild dogs out there, the coyotes, and they're just way smarter than his dogs. And, you know, they're going to give his dogs problems. I won't get into the whole story, but, like, you know, there's an encounter between him and his wife. His wife scares him off, whatever. And the coyotes are smarter. They can outsmart everyone there. But at some point, they're going to call the authorities, and someone's going to sneak up behind the coyote and shoot it in the back of the head. And are we the coyotes? And in a lot of ways, fast forward a few years, he would probably argue, and I don't want to speak for him, and I didn't necessarily agree with everything he said, but I thought it was really compelling what he had to say. That maybe we're in that coyote moment now with, you know, the Bitcoin ETFs and the way things are playing out. Like, who knows? And we always seem to be kind of running into these things, and there is no we, and Bitcoin doesn't care about any of this stuff. But, you know, we're like, now Grayscale's selling off, and no one saw that coming. And everyone saw the ETF as a positive in terms of price action. It's just, you never know what's around the corner.
I remember that podcast specifically. I remember the analogy. I think Ben Hunt, Epsilon Theory, is a crafty guy because there's a lot of reasoning via analogy, and he pontificates as if he sort of knows how things work, and he doesn't really know how things work. When you fast forward to, you know, the launch of the Bitcoin ETFs, yeah, I mean, it should be obvious to anybody who's paying attention that, like, this is an attempted co-option of Bitcoin. Of course. Yes, that's the game. We can all see it. The game is on. The game is afoot. Like, it's happening, you know? And so, like, to me, the outcome of the game is to be determined. I'm not going to sit here and pound my chest and act like I know the outcome, because I don't, because it's a very sort of complicated thing that we have to walk through. But there are some fundamental things about Bitcoin that give me, you know, hope that this meeting of Wall Street and Bitcoin is not Wall Street eating Bitcoin, but it's actually Bitcoin eating Wall Street. And, you know, you don't know the fucking horse is full of Trojans until you fucking let it in, and then you're fucked, right? I mean, that's kind of how it works. So, you know, Wall Street thinks it's eating us. We think we're eating Wall Street. It's anyone's guess as to who is correct. But, you know, the shadow prohibition of Bitcoin, or the actual prohibition of Bitcoin that could occur, or the attempted co-option of Bitcoin, whatever you want to call it, I think is a necessary part of Bitcoin's journey. And I've always, you know, from the very first moment I first got into Bitcoin back in, like, late 2014, early 2015, I always had this vision of two ways this can go. And the one way this can go is Bitcoin stalls out 500k to a million, maybe up to 2 million, and it's digital gold. It's co-opted and controlled. Self-custody is not illegal, but the reporting requirements are onerous. People don't want to deal with it. You can get margin on the ETFs. It's easy to buy the Bitcoin, run the Michael Saylor buy, borrow, die strategy with the ETFs. So you put your Bitcoin Litecoin into the ETFs, then you're able to margin, buy a nice home, and get nice things and do all the stuff you ever wanted to without even selling your Bitcoin. What an amazing deal. But then, you know, Bitcoin is co-opted and controlled, and, you know, it never really moves much beyond gold. It does eventually demonetize gold, but that's about where it settles out and it finds its level there. That's scenario one, right? Scenario two is Bitcoin goes through this co-option or ghettoization period, and is able to come out the other side and shine in a crisis. And the crisis would probably be, you know, a hyperinflationary event, right? Which is, you know, always, it should be noted for the audience, is always demarcated by a loss of confidence in the currency. So if you see a widespread loss of confidence in the currency, look out, because hyperinflation is here. So for me, it's like, I don't know which one of those paths or outcomes is most likely, but I'm here for either one. And, you know, in one, you're going to have wealth, moderate wealth with slightly reduced freedom, which is to say you're going to be just like people that invest in tech stocks or something. And then in the other, you know, path, you're going to be the new wealthy elite and some sort of rogue revolutionary that the powers that be want to murder, which is the shooting the coyote in the head story. So we will see. We got both of those options available to us, Cedric. So, like, I don't know which one it's going to be, but it's going to be exciting either way. You know,
I agree. It already is exciting. What do you think you're going to spend your stats on in 20 to 30 years from now that will really matter?
Yeah, so it's tough, right? Because in terms of investments, like, we don't know the way the world is going to progress over the next 20 to 30 years. And so you got to keep your eye on the ball at all times. At some point, Bitcoin is going to level off and, you know, you won't be able to get the same sort of return that you got during the monetization of Bitcoin. And some people will say, well, that's fine. I've made enough money. I don't need to do investing anymore. I don't want to do that. But if you do feel so compelled to continue to place bets on the future and sort of, you know, affect the outcome of the future, like I do, I feel compelled in that way, then you're going to want to continue investing your Bitcoin for, you know, better. There's always going to be companies that are able to,
well, I mean,
you know,
how would you
capital.
How would you want to reshape society in a way that's meaningful?
Yeah, yeah. So I was getting there. It's all good. So for me, I think that Bitcoin is a fundamentally like restorative and a progressive technology. So it's progressive in the sense that, like, yeah, we have a new digital money, which is encrypted by, you know, energy in cyberspace or cyber hornets or whatever Michael Saylor says. And then we also, you know, it restores a lot of what we lost on a gold standard. So if you look at sort of the periods of low inflation across society is going from, you know, way back in antiquity to modern day, periods where, you know, the nation is young, the regime is young, and the credit is good, and the money schedule is tight, the monetary policy is tight. Those are the periods that we remember as the good periods. And then the periods in which, you know, things are loose, the regime is corrupt, and the credit is going slowly bust, those are the periods we see as the bad periods. So for me, I would fundamentally like to see Bitcoin give America another 300 years. I think that would be exciting because I look around at the global players and I don't see anybody that can compete with America. But Bitcoin needs to help America live up to its fundamental promises, which it's not doing a good job of today. And we can all admit that, right? And so, you know, my ideal scenario is that Bitcoin is like a public works project, which, you know, sort of helps revitalize American economy, American capitalism, American business, American civics, and, you know, proliferates that to the rest of the globe as well. Because one of the beautiful things is that if you were in the 20th century, Americans did pretty well. And like Canadians did pretty well in terms of like the stock market and stuff. Your Australians did pretty well. But like, you know, if you were in Europe, you had to go through two fucking world wars that were on your doorstep, you know, like your house might have gotten bombed out. You know, it wasn't very good to live in Europe during the 20th century. Right. And so I think that in a way, the regime that you're under matters a whole hell of a lot. And the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that, you know, you can now opt out of your whatever sovereign regime you find yourself under and opt into, you know, a fair rules based system that has sort of enshrined property rights for all global citizens. It's a big deal. You know, Bitcoin doesn't care if you're Iranian. Bitcoin doesn't care if you're from Somalia. Bitcoin doesn't care if you're Venezuelan. Bitcoin works the same way for fucking everybody on the planet. And that's crucially important, you know, I think. So, yeah, in terms of like investment, I would love to see, there's a whole host of technologies I would love to see come to the forefront. You know, the AI thing I think is boring, actually. Like until we get to real world AI, I'm kind of bored by the computer spits out gibberish words. I think other people like that. I don't like it. It's stupid. Look, the computer made an image that looks kind of crappy. Cool, man. I'm not that into that. I want the Jetsons future. I fall into like the Peter Thiel framework of thinking where like we were promised flying cars. Where's my goddamn flying car? I want, you know, flying cars. I want the fucking vacuum tubes. I want the fucking replicator from Star Trek. I want all that shit. That's what I want. And so can we get to work on building that? We're either like, listen, humanity's either going to fucking die off. We're going to kill ourselves off in a nuclear holocaust, or we're going to the stars. There is no in between for us. We can't just stay here in this middle ground. You're right. We have to like go forth and seed the cosmos or press the nuke button and kill everybody. Like those are the only two options. You know, it's a binary for me.
Yeah, I agree. It's just like Bitcoin going to zero or infinity. Some of these things just play out that way in nature.
Yeah.
Is number go up like a drug? We were talking about drugs earlier on the show.
100%. My God, it's the best drug on earth. There's nothing like it. Every bull cycle top, I feel like I'm just mainlining cocaine, just right into the veins, you know? And yeah, I've done cocaine, Cedric. This is better than cocaine. It feels amazing. So it's like when you, that's usually the time you want to check yourself too. When you're feeling euphoric, when you're walking around being like, I'm the smartest person that ever lived. Everybody that doubted me is going to fucking beg for my forgiveness. You know, like listen, these are not kind thoughts, but they all pop into all of our heads. We can admit it. When you're feeling that way, it might be a sign that things have gotten a little frothy in the markets, you know. Conversely, though, when we're at the bottom and, you know, you're feeling like you're the dumbest person that ever lived and you're going to lose all your money, that might be a good buying opportunity, right? Probably the best buying opportunity of your life. In fact, like I've talked about this before, but yeah, the best buys of my life, especially in Bitcoin, I was literally sick to my stomach when I made them. I bought Bitcoin at 3,500 in 2018, which was only 300 off the actual bottom of like 3,200. And I remember I felt like I was going to throw up. I had to take a walk around the block to calm myself down. And my internal mantra was like, you're the dumbest person that ever lived. You just threw away all your money. You just destroyed your family's future. You're a fucking idiot, you know, all that kind of stuff. I had to like calm down. Those turned out to be amazing buys. Those were like some of my best buys in Bitcoin ever, right? So like, if you're feeling that way, you should fade yourself both directions. So fade yourself when you're too, like probably don't trade your Bitcoin, but just, you know, don't do anything stupid during the bull market, right? Like I'm not telling you to trade. I'm just saying, don't go buy a mansion, you know, like on the assumption that you're going to be 3X as rich in 6 months. Like, cause you like, you probably won't be, it's probably the top, you know, like maybe it's not the time to stay in the presidential suite. Maybe you don't need to fly first class, you know, like.
Yeah. Lifestyle creep. It's amazing though. I mean, what you, that power you gave to me in 2019, where I was like, yeah, I feel like we're the smartest people in the room and I'm lucky to be here. Like, holy fucking shit. Like, this is really important. And I don't care. Like, that's what was so great about Bitcoin, especially my background in accounting and finance, like looking at it as a ledger and numbers, like you can't dispute certain things about this system. And then, so like you were saying, like listening to, for me, because that was before I did the pod, before I met anyone in real life. So I would tune into the pod. That was where I was getting my, what I felt like real conversation in the world, but really signal and moving my life along in a better direction, building my life and in my free time. But I was like, holy shit, this is like my time. This is a time, you know? And I did want to share with everyone. And I sounded like a freak and a cult and like, you know, and I now reserve myself from that. But it's now like when number goes up, I almost get a little nervous. Like, what does that mean? It's like that moment in The Big Short when you're like, do you know what this fucking means for everybody? Being in that bear market moment and having that conviction, that's how you kind of, I think, buy low, sell high, or whatever one people are calling that. I'm not encouraging buy low, sell high, that whole thing. My point is, though, is that when you really kind of, that's your opportunity to believe in something that other people don't. And it's not about a belief or just having hope, but putting the work in, gaining the knowledge and understanding this thing. And it's listening to others. I mean, it's, or not listening to others. It's not just doing what they say, but like kind of hearing ideas, bouncing things off, trying to beat this thing up, attack it. That was what brought me into Bitcoin was, I fled Facebook looking for some sort of signal in 2016. And I'm floating around Twitter. I couldn't understand Twitter for anything. And in 2017, you know, all of a sudden I'm probably on FinTwit because I'm interested in economics and macro. I'm trying to figure out what's going on in the world and politics. And Bitcoiners are just yelling at me in Twitter. And that makes me very like, I'm going to argue with them. I'm going to want to shut this person up and put the argument to rest. Because the way they would argue would be very like, you can't prove me wrong. Go prove me wrong. Number go up forever.
Yeah.
You say something like that, I'm like, oh, come on, hold on. And I'd be like, well, and I'd look at all these rabbit holes and I'd be like, well, I can't prove anything's wrong. And then, you know, I'm class of 2017. It's very much to your point. I came in the fall of 2017. So you then 8 weeks later, I am a genius, you know, on everything too. Ethereum, Litecoin, you name it. And I'm now the authority on cryptocurrency. And, you know, and you, you know, and then 3 months later, you're poor. And you're just like, what am I holding on to? And now you have to not just figure out Bitcoin versus shitcoin, but like, why am I even holding this Bitcoin? And do I throw more good money after bad? And that's what it's all about in terms of conviction. Like, you know, otherwise you would just sell your whole bag and move on to the next idea, you know? And
100%. It's interesting. I remember that in 2017, by the way, the dumbest guy in my high school was running a Facebook group for shit coins. And I was like, of course, you know, I was already a pretty maximalist at that point. Like I didn't really ever own shit coins. Maybe for the first like few weeks when I first got here, I bought like some Ripple and some Doge or some shit.
Yeah.
And then I sold it pretty quickly thereafter. But like, yeah, man, that was a crazy time. I spent the whole time arguing, probably with people like yourself. Like maybe we even crossed paths. Yeah.
Yeah, I kept coming home. I'd tell my wife about American Hoddle. Remember, heavily armed clown. I'm like, babe, I'm learning a lot from this clown. And he's dropping truth bombs. And we got to study up on this stuff.
I'm the same way. I'm like, yeah, you know, babe, Bongman 420, like he's doing a pod today. So I got to listen in. Got to know what he's talking about. Like,
it's one of the reasons I started the show, because I wanted to be able to say, I know I have to finish this pod. Like I'm listening to this. I'm prepping. I'm doing my work here.
Mm-hmm.
So and you talk about sort of like being on Twitter then. And so what is your favorite Bitcoin meme? We have to talk about your meme.
Yeah. So Stacking Sats is my favorite meme. Stacking Sats is a sister meme to HODL. See, these memes, when you've been around for a while, the memes are daisy chained together. So like HODL's the big daddy meme, right? Which is not, by the way, sometimes people ask me, they're like, are you the guy who created HODL? I'm like, no. That was before my time, and that's a different guy, and yada yada. That's a moniker. Like that's like a rallying cry. Like we all, you know, he didn't know what he created at the time.
But you created, I mean, there's Texas HODL, there's Indian HODL, there's a British lot of HODL.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a thing.
So HODL, I think, is the big meme, and you would have to say it's the best. And then, you know, I like Mats, which is Stacking Sats, which you know, is, I like it because it's alliterative. It changes the denominator. There was a whole discourse about should we do bits for sats. Matt leapfrogged everybody by just setting it to the lowest possible unit and being like, fuck you all, my meme is sats, deal with it. Nobody's got a bits meme. If you did want to compete with Matt, you would have to fucking do a bits meme, but nobody's done one. So Matt wins. And then my meme is like a companion meme to Matt's meme, which is 6.15, which is like, well, okay, how many sats should we stack? And it's like 6.15 Bitcoin worth. That's how many you should get, you know? And so, yeah, I think all these memes just, they flow into each other. And, you know, good meme craft is really about distillation of ideas, getting it down to its like finest essence. And the person I learned that from is Michael Goldstein, aka Bitstein, who is a legend, absolute legend in the game. Him and Pierre basically like single-handedly created every meme. You know, they like the Nakamoto Institute that those guys worked out of, like Everyone's a Scammer came out of that. Hyper Bitcoinization came out of that. So many great things. So like, yeah, I think that the culture around Bitcoin, the memes around Bitcoin, the distillation of ideas, it's always going to be endlessly fascinating to me. And it is interesting to see, like, you know, memes propagating themselves the same way genes propagating themselves, just, you know, through the internet, using the internet as their mechanism of action. Everything's a meme. Donald Trump's presidency is a meme. Fucking Harambe's sainthood is a meme. You know, the Bitcoin going to, you know, dethrone the dollar for reserve currency is a meme. It's all memes. It's all memes all the way down. Christianity, the golden rule, is a meme. Everything's a meme. It's all memes. There's nothing in the world that's not a meme.
I now agree. I remember, you know, I started the show and then I would be on Twitter and I was trying to figure out how to tweet. And CK Snarks DM me one day and he's like, stop what you're doing. Your tweets are horrible. You need to learn how to meme. It's like, fuck. What the fuck does even meme mean? You know, and I kind of knew it. I was like, what the fuck? And I'm looking at how to fucking meme. You know? Like, there's going to be a guidebook somewhere, you know. But
I love his honesty of just like, hey, your shit sucks. Fix it.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it.
I will.
That's what a friend did. You know, he was a big supporter of the show early on. And he gave me some constructive feedback. There's, CK's, you know,
the man.
Yeah. Pierre Richard, you know, definitely with Bitstein on Mount Rushmore of Bitcoin, you know, if we're going to put anyone up there. And they got the Sell Your Chairs and Speculative Attack article. And
Run
there's
the Numbers is Pierre's.
Run the numbers. That's a good one.
Such a great one. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, you got Laser Eyes to 100K. And, you know, you kind of look at Stack Sats, though, but is it Stay Humble and Stack Sats? I think that would be the way Matt would put it.
I would say probably Matt's. Yeah, it's both.
I think he's humble first and it's both.
It used to be just Stacking Sats, and then it became Stay Humble and Stack Sats. I think that's the correct etymology of Matt's.
I get why you've never you probably have a block on the Stay Humble part.
Well, my thing with Matt, I used to tell him, it's like, you don't have to stay humble because Bitcoin will humble you. So it's like, don't even worry. You're going to get humbled no matter what, you know? But I think Matt's advice was probably good advice, which is like, yes, you definitely should like attempt to stay humble because this thing is going to really fuck with your emotions. You know, I mean, sometimes I meet Bitcoiners who think that they're like, I'm stoic, bro. I'm in my Bitcoin Zen, bro. I got ice water in my veins, dude. I don't even think about it, you know? And I'm just like, are you? Because maybe it's just me, but I feel emotional about this thing. And I think a lot of people do too, you know? So like, maybe you're the one guy who's just, you're cold-blooded, bro. But I'm not cold-blooded, man. I'm a fucking emotional, you know?
Maybe, are you the irresponsible Bitcoiner? Are you giving the voice, you know, to the irresponsibility in all of us? Who just do sometimes want to while out, even if, like, you know, maybe people got low time preference, but they do got that inner voice maybe. And I'll say, I mean, I think it really does help people like it, that positive aspect of, or that rah rahness or whatever you want to call it, that rocky voice, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It was one of the things I thought it was really interesting that Jay-Z said, someone asked him like, who are the most surprising people you would think ever listen to your music or do listen to music? And he was like, he said he was really surprised that like hedge fund executives and investment bankers crank his music before they go do a presentation.
Yeah.
You know, but it makes sense. Like, he's got that sort of that Rocky story or that rags to riches story. And do you think, and I think that's sort of what you were giving voice to, I think, and saying like, you can make it to the other side.
It was sort of a cultural taboo in Bitcoin to be as outwardly confident and as outwardly bullish as I was and to have as much conviction as I did. And so, you know, yeah, breaking that taboo was fun at the time. And it really emanates from a place of, that's just who I am. That's how I feel. I've always felt wildly confident about this thing. Now, maybe I'm wrong and I'm an idiot. And again, I've always held that possibility open, like, that this all ends in disaster for me and everybody laughs at me and, you know, like I just lose everything. Totally. That possibility is open. It's always there. But, you know, over time, I think things have played out in my favor and the conviction has won out. And certainly, you know, some of the things we said were going to happen, a lot of the things we said were going to happen have happened. And, you know, when you see the world clearly, I was talking to my wife about this the other day, that basically, like, the truth sucks, right? Like, the truth is fucking painful, man. It's always painful. It's way better to live in a delusion or in a fantasy. And most people do live in a delusion or in a fantasy. So there's like this very small percentage of the world who is willing to like engage with radical truth, like 100% truth. And it's mainly a negative, like, for your life. It's kind of got a lot of downsides because, number one, other people don't want to hear the truth. So if you say it to them, they don't want to fucking hear it from you. Number two, you see how like awful most things actually are, right? Like, behind the curtain that's covering them up, most things are pretty terrible, right? The way the world works is pretty terrible. And it's kind of the same as in ancient times. It's still all the same. The stuff you think is like thuggery from the Roman Empire, where they would just show up to a senator's house and just kill his family in front of him. That shit still goes on. It just has new names, but it's the same thing, right? And so, like, in a way, seeing the world in an honest and transparent fashion is brutal, and the individuals that engage in it are, they do it only because they are compelled to do so, and they simply must, because they need to order their world in the correct fashion. But the silver lining of it is it allows you to read financial markets pretty easily, and you can get rich doing it. So, like, if you see the world clearly, the silver lining is you get to get rich. The rest of it is all awful, but the getting rich part is pretty good. It's, you know, also, I think scientists share this too, because science is a brutal, horrible, awful, thorny process if done correctly. Not modeling as science, not what they did during COVID. I'm talking about real science, where you're testing hypotheses, and every day you go into the lab and you're just getting your dick kicked in because none of the results match what you thought was going to happen. That's real fucking science. And, you know, those guys do it for, they do it for the leveling up of humanity. They do it because, you know, it's rewarding work, but really they simply just have to see the world that way. It's like you're sort of like touched by God in a certain way, where you just simply must engage with truth. Because mm-hmm. the truth is awful and no other human being wants to deal with it. So you become like the scapegoat here, where you're the only person, you know, you and the others like you are the only people who are engaging in it, you know.
Yeah, I hate being there sometimes. It makes me think about hard choices, easy life, easy choices, hard life.
Yeah.
And makes me think, that episode with Marty and Matt, one of my favorite Bitcoin episodes of all time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you brought up the mandibles in that episode. Yes. And when I asked Matt to talk on the show, he said, I won't talk to you until you've read the mandibles. And I had to promise him that I read it by chat day. I got it done. So I thought that was really, it was interesting going back to that episode and how things haven't really changed much.
Right,
you could
right.
play it and release it like it was today.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely recommend people go back, check that out. What was your take on the mandibles?
Well, I feel proud that I was the first person to shill the mandibles to Matt Odell, because it's like his favorite book now, and you know. So I feel good that I'm I used to be an even more avid reader than I am now. Oh, you got it right there. I bought a first edition because Matt bought a first edition, so I got one too. I was like, I'm not going to let Matt have a first edition when I'm the one who shilled it to him. So yeah, I got one of those. I read the book back in like 2015, probably, or maybe really? Early 16. I can't remember when it came out. But I read it when it came out, and I remember just being like, holy shit, this is like one of the greatest, you know, dystopic novels that I've read, because it's about what I think is actually a reality and going to come due. And I think the mandibles will continue to grow as a book. Like that book is way ahead of its time. It's like 25, 30 years ahead of its time. Right. And so, you know, the mandibles movie will be 20 years from now or whatever. Right. But yeah, I remember reading it, and it has such a great ending. I don't want to spoil it, but I will. So spoilers, the ending is like, he gets to Nevada, and it's like the free state of Nevada, and it's a libertarian paradise. And, you know, they all think they have a bomb in their head, and he crosses into Nevada, and he's surprised when it doesn't blow up. So the whole thing's a psyop, right? And then he gets to Nevada, and, you know, he's talking about the libertarian paradise and how it works. And the guy goes, well, yeah, we just got a flat tax. It's just 10%. And that's it. It's fair, nice and fair and normal, the way things should be, you know, whatever. And then the last line of the book is that year taxes rose to 11%. Right. And I just love that so much, which is like, yeah, the human cycle repeats. It's mm-hmm. we cannot stay in paradise. We simply have to ruin paradise. That's our story. That's the fall of man, right? Like, that's in the Bible.
Yeah. And
it's the oldest human story. We fucking hate utopias. We hate it. When things are good, we will do anything to ruin it. And so I think that even if we could get a libertarian paradise, like, that's why Bitcoin's not utopic. I used to think it was. I think a lot of people do think it is when they first come in. But at the end of the day, like, you just got a bunch of fucking shitty humans who are going to be the owners of the Bitcoin, and they're going to do whatever they're going to do with it. This is why I think like ossification is preferable at some point, because we really want to take, you know, changes out of the hands of human beings. Because like right now we're almost getting to a comical place with like the Vatican style, you know, core development process. Like it's almost getting time, but we're not there yet. But soon enough, like I think ultimately the big idea behind Bitcoin is we get rid of humans from the system, and then the system propagates itself like over time, and humans can do whatever games they want to do, bastardize the world in whichever way they want to bastardize it. But at the end of the day, Bitcoin is going to remain unchanged because it's a fair rules-based system. And the more human intervention we have in Bitcoin, the worse off Bitcoin is going to be. But we don't, it's still tricky because it's still early and we don't know when we're supposed to close up shop on the project, you know? So that's like an open question. I think it would probably be premature to ossify now, but maybe not, you know, 10 years from now. I don't know. We'll see.
Sooner than later, I would think. I kind of agree with you. It's kind of getting scary just thinking about changing anything anymore. I think it's almost, yeah, I mean, it's so big now. Yeah, so that's an interesting thought. Like, when does it fully ossify? And I got to think it's sooner than later.
The big question is, you know, is not changing Bitcoin an attack on Bitcoin?
Mm-hmm.
Or is changing Bitcoin an attack on Bitcoin? And I'm, dude, honestly, like with the ETF launch right now, I'm not sure I know the answer to that anymore, right? Because it kind of seems like the way Bitcoin is now is working for the powers that be. Or at least they have a playbook that none of us are privy to where they think they can control it in XYZ fashion. But maybe if it gets a change or an upgrade or this or that, then it becomes a little more uncontrollable.
Yeah.
So maybe it behooves the powers that be to not change it, but maybe it doesn't. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I can't like come to a solid conclusion on this, but this is a question I've been mulling over in the back of my mind for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's something to definitely think about. And when you talk about the mandibles, I mean, I saw it as very dystopic. I saw the outcome as dystopic and not maybe as circular, like we were getting back to the positive 10% tax or something like that. But, and I also saw, I mean, it was interesting how quick they brought up Bitcoin and dismissed it.
Yes.
And I thought that, and so I wrote it off as well. It was so early in Bitcoin that maybe you could just take that sort of like, this thing can't be what they think it is. But I also thought maybe that's where her understanding of economics ended and she just couldn't go further. And it seemed like, because for a while it seemed like the younger character was the hero of the book until she kind of got fed up with him not stopping talking about this thing called Bitcoin, essentially.
Yeah,
having fair money. And then she switched to the uncle being the hero of the book or the protagonist of the book. And he was just an asshole banker, you know, and I thought that was strange. And then there was this whole story of just like sibling, like rivalry, where it's like the oldest sibling should kind of be better off than the younger sibling. But then that whole thing gets thrown out in the water in this dystopic economic outcome.
She did a pod with Matt where she said that basically that Bitcoin line is just a throwaway because she didn't know anything about Bitcoin. She just heard about it and she thought she'd just throw it in there. As like, oh yeah, Bitcoin didn't work, you know.
Which she at that point probably had a good odds of that line working out.
She's relatively
it didn't age well, but
she's relatively orange pilled at this point in time, I think. And I think Matt set her up with a wallet, and she's got, you know. So you should listen if you haven't heard it. That podcast with her and Matt is great. She's very based and like sort of she's like an older woman and sort of like cranky. In like a fun way, you know, so I actually enjoyed it a lot, you know,
and I'd love to chat with her. And she was interesting. I don't think she didn't write a lot about economics before or after that. It's a dystopic economic novel, which most of them are science dystopia or whatever. So it's cool that it was economics based, but it wasn't. And she seemed to really grok a lot of it.
Yeah.
Up until a certain point. So, yeah, no, I could get that.
Totally.
You know, I was want to know what you think maybe of the economy.
Yeah.
And if you're going to get involved in a presidential bet on the outcome of this election, maybe with Peter McCormack.
By the way, I feel like Peter, now knowing what we know about the Twitter files, I think Peter owes me that money back. You know what I mean? I mean, that election was stolen straight up. via collusion from the Democrats, big tech, and the FBI. Like, that's obvious now. We know that, right? So, like, Peter, you owe me half a coin, my guy. Just letting you know. But yeah, no, I would. If we're talking about markets and the economy and politics, like, you know, it seems obvious that Trump is the front runner right now for the 2024 election, and he's still not great on Bitcoin. He was pretty awful on Bitcoin, but you know, maybe Vivek is VP. Vivek is pretty good on Bitcoin. He said no CBDCs recently, which is great. And, you know, he did an NFT trading card collection. So maybe he's warmed up to Bitcoin, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, so I think like him or love him, hate him or whatever, unless there is something drastic that happens in the political process, we are probably going to get Trump for four more years in 2024. Joe Biden just seems to be a total non-starter as a candidate. And then, you know, in terms of the economy, what do we know about a Trump election? Well, if Trump gets elected, Trump has expressed interest in negative rates. So Trump is going to fucking, you know, politicize the Fed like nobody's business. He did it all during his first term. He's going to do it during his second term. And he's going to get them to lower the rates as low as humanly possible. Because the only thing Trump actually cares about is him being on television and what the stock market does under his watch, right? Those are the two things he cares about. And so, and he wants to be on television talking about the stock market, combining both of his loves. But yeah, when he was president, he used to give conferences to like talk down the markets or talk up the markets ahead of the weekend. You know, it's like, I've never seen a president who was that obsessed with the markets before, which is, you know, because he's a businessman. So like, of course. So yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to see printing during a Trump regime. We're going to see, you know, a lowering of rates and easing of rates during a Trump regime, and probably no more fiscal stimulus. I think fiscal stimulus is out. So because the big lesson that they learned during 2020 was we can't give the poor money because they'll spend it on stupid shit and cause inflation. I mean, listen, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that's what the powers that be think. And so, yeah, no fiscal stimulus, but more monetary stimulus, more stimulus for, you know, banks, overnight repos, things like that, whatever. You know, how like they come up with a million different new terms. There's like this BTFP program now and BTFD program. And like they I don't even know how that works. It's like a new swap line thing or something. So like, dude, these guys like are constantly reinventing terms and ways to inject liquidity. But at the end of the day, it's all printing. It's all just money printing. You know, so we're going to get easing. We're going to get lowered rates under Trump. If Trump doesn't win, I don't think Biden will care as much about the economy in his second term. So maybe expect rates to stay high, but with potentially still stimulus. So that's what I would think if Biden wins.
It's going to be a fascinating year. Yeah. Can't wait to see it play out.
Another shit show. Another American shit show.
Oh, man. Well, you know, what do you think of Twitter, and why did you make such a conscious decision to get off of Twitter?
Yeah, so I got off during the bull market, and then I came back on. And the reason I got off during the bull market is because I just straight up don't like the bull market on Twitter. It annoys me to no end. It's not like a bigger reason than that. It just fucking annoys me because these shitcoiners who just got here 10 minutes ago are like on parade because they made, you know, they turned 10 grand into $1 million overnight on Cum Rocket coin or some stupid bullshit. And then they want to tell you like, oh yeah, Cum Rocket's the future. It's going to fucking overtake Bitcoin. And you're just like, oh my God, shut the fuck up. Stop talking to me. So for me, it just annoys me to no end. And I like bear markets better personally. And I probably will disappear again during this bull cycle. I'll just delete the whole account. Because, again, I'm not interested in having followers or whatever. So I'll just delete the account, fucking bounce, and then come back during the next bear market. You know, that's sort of my plan. Because I can't argue with the Cum Rocket guys again. Like, no thanks.
That's interesting that you're just going to delete it, though, and come back. I mean, yeah. I get not caring about the followers from one perspective. But, I mean, I think this is one of your biggest accounts you've ever had.
Yeah, I couldn't give a shit less, Cedric. Like, truly, I like really couldn't care less.
That's awesome, bro.
Yeah, it's just not. Listen, I don't monetize the account or anything. It's just me talking shit.
Yeah, no, I get it.
But it's like, what do I really care? There's people in Bitcoin I really like and want to keep tabs with. But you know,
there's other methods now.
There's other methods. I know a lot of those people, and so, yeah, so it's like, you know, I just don't care. I don't care about the follower account thing. I also think like we are in a new era. Like the ETF thing is a brand new thing. In the first decade, it was like a lot of grassroots stuff. So like guys like, you know, us were more needed. And I don't know if we're as needed going forward, you know?
Yeah, man.
Because it's there's going to be $100 million Bitcoin advertising campaigns and shit, you know?
Yeah, I think they're going to be shitty ones, but some people are going to be sweating them and thinking they're great. And maybe they'll be great for, you know, maybe normie land and stuff. And I mean, I just think that Bitcoin is so anti-Wall Street, just in its essence and ethos and what I try to get out of Bitcoin. Try to get away from the financialization of society, trying to get away from trying to spend 30% of my time trying to create the perfect money in my portfolio just to maintain my purchasing power. And I want them to have nothing to do with that. And I like having an asset that no one comes between me and the thing.
Yeah.
And so unfortunately,
though, there's nothing we can do.
And I have no problem with, you know, this is a free country. And I don't mean that in terms of how much freedom we have under the law, but like, go do what you want. And like, you know, it's like this whole argument with our ordinals. And I think one of the ways I've kind of heard it is like, you know, people are like, oh, well, you know, if miners aren't, you know, processing ordinals, well, they're just, you know, they're not getting all the fees, man. They're not true profit chasing capitalists. And it's like, well, yeah, well, there's people on OnlyFans and you can go on OnlyFans, but I'm not putting my wife and kids on OnlyFans. And I don't think I'm denying myself any revenue. I'm not forsaking revenue. I'm just maintaining my ethics and values and morals. And I'm not saying you can't go to OnlyFans, but it's like, be crazy for me to do anything over there. But like, that doesn't mean that I'm telling you what you can and can't do. And I'm not telling you can't go to the OnlyFans store, but over here, it's a family store. I
think it's interesting of where we're at in Bitcoin, because you know there are a lot of things that I think there's like blind spots. There's Bitcoiner blind spots that are now becoming, they're not blind spots anymore. People can see them now. So like one of them is like, you know, the Wall Street's attempted financialization / takeover of Bitcoin. That's happening in earnest now. Shitcoin's collapsing. And then shitcoin activity flowing into Bitcoin, that's happening now. And then, you know, I think like culturally, there's a lot of us who feel like we have a lot of ownership over this thing and the narrative and et cetera. But the truth is that Bitcoin's a unwieldy beast, and like it's an evolutionary system. And it's like from simple rules, complexity emerges, right? And Bitcoin is a very simple rules-based system, which is like emerging higher and higher complexities all the time. And so to think we, you know, just because we understand Bitcoin in this one moment in time, the snapshot of it, that we're going to understand it forever, I think it's going to continue to grow beyond us, you know, and there are going to be a lot of people that are using Bitcoin in a way that like you don't approve of and I don't approve of, or different, you know, there's going to be different ethics, different. There is no Bitcoin monolith culture, but there are many Bitcoin cultures, you know, different flavors of Bitcoin. And that's to be expected if it's going to be the world's, you know, currency, right? There's gold in electronics. There's gold on the Queen of England's throne. There's gold in the ISS. There's gold on the Titanic. You know what I mean? There's gold everywhere. Like there's a million different flavors of gold too. So yeah, I kind of try and stay in this pocket of like watching the evolutionary process of Bitcoin, trying to accurately detail what's happening, not stick my head in the sand about stuff, even if it's stuff I don't like, and then try and think through the second and third order effects of that new stuff that's happening, you know? Because, dude, even still, like we haven't even maxed the design space on layer one. So like people talk about, you know, Lightning all the time. We haven't even maxed out the efficiency on layer one yet. There's just a lot more innings to go in the Bitcoin story, like a million more chapters, you know, and we're going to be dead for most of them. Like Bitcoin's a 1,000-year plus project. So yeah, truthfully, like we're just some weirdos sitting here at the precipice of this thing, trying to figure it the fuck out. You know, and like I think that's like a humbleness too. It's just like, yeah, sometimes, you know, Bitcoin is beyond me and I don't really know what's going on, even though I've been here almost a decade now. Yeah. You know.
Well, I kind of see it like maybe like, you know, when George Washington went to the pub and was trying to figure out all this shit with, you know, the revolution with his buddies. I mean, maybe we're not Washington and his buddy, but like we're in that pub and we're having the conversations that everyone's having, trying to figure this thing out.
Yeah, yeah.
We're in the salon, you know, and trying to hash out what's going on here. I do agree with you. No one understands Bitcoin. I think the key, you know, is if I'll go back to CK Snarks. No one's bullish enough on Bitcoin.
Yeah,
appreciate
yeah.
what you have. Get you and your family to the promised land or the finish line. Maybe that's 2030. Maybe that's 2040. But it's not going to be easy to get there. This has been so dope. I'm going to read a tweet from you before I leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you. You tweeted out, "Good morning. You know what I did before I bought Bitcoin? Fucking believed in myself. Start there." This is the American HODL I'm here for. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you being on the show. So I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you.
No, dude, I think it's important. Yeah, you got to believe that your life can be better. You know, you got to believe that you don't have to believe in Bitcoin because Bitcoin's just math, but you have to believe that you are the kind of person who can participate in the Bitcoin story and that you can be a player here and your life can matter. And it's like a choose your own adventure game where, you know, you just make the decision. Like Cedric didn't start out as like to be anointed as a Bitcoin podcaster, right? He just did it and he like stumbled his way through and made shitty tweets that CK Snarks told him sucked and, you know, just kept going until he figured it out and now has one of the better podcasts in Bitcoin. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it's a choose your own adventure game and you got to scratch your own itch when you're here in Bitcoin. So I think it does start with like the decision to just say, I can have a better life. I can be, you know, worth more money. I can be healthier. I can be happier. I can have good relationships, etc. And then you got to like be consistent over time about those things. And yeah, lean on the people who are here and, you know, fucking HODL, man. Like HODL for prosperity, you know?
Awesome, bro.
That's it, bro.
Thank you so much.
Oh, dude, I got to say, my buddy Dave is a huge fan of your show. And so I told him I'd shout him out. So Dave, what's up, man?
Awesome, Dave. Hey, bro. Shout out. Thank you so much, man. This was great.
Dude, it was great to be here.
Hey, that's a wrap on today's episode of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast with American HODL. I hope that you found it as enjoyable and enlightening as I did. Hit us up. We'd love to hear your feedback. I want to thank you for tuning in. Finally, if you could write a 5-star review for the Bitcoin Matrix podcast wherever you listen to your pods, that would really help get the word out and help new listeners find the show. Keep building, keep stacking, and always stay laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.